Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Well, dominating the news this week, the countdown to the so-called fiscal cliff as lawmakers try to negotiate a financial deal before automatic spending cuts go into effect in January. Also in January, South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint will leave the Senate to head up the Heritage Foundation. What does that mean for conservatives and the Tea Party? Well, temperatures are on the rise in D.C. and all over the world. The World Bank just released an alarming report on global climate change. Will anyone take action? And in Mexico, a new president was sworn into office this week. Enrique Peña Nieto of the Pri Party takes the reins in that country. And antivirus tech guru John McAfee was arrested and then hospitalized in Guatemala after being denied asylum. So we'll talk about all of those stories and the week's news with Andrea Seabrook, who's the founder of Decode DC, and she was formerly a reporter, a correspondent for NPR. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Good to be here. Thank you.
She's here in studio in San Francisco. Go with us. And Mike McAuliffe is senior congressional reporter for the Huffington Post. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Good to be here. And we're also joined by Carrie Kahn, who's NPR's foreign correspondent, and she's based in Mexico City, Mexico. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Holly.
Great to have you on. So we're going to start the show like we do every Friday with a positive note to give kudos to a reporter who's done a good job this week. Let's start with you, Andrea. What did you see or hear or read that you want to give a shout out?
Well, just to state my own conflict of interest here, I'm going to shout out to a very old friend of mine who is an amazing reporter. His name is Brendan Greeley. He's at Bloomberg Business Week, and he did an amazing story called The High Cost of Congress's Budget Procrastination. Hmm. And it points out, amid all of the hysteria that's been going on now for what, 2 years, about the, you know, the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling and all this, he points out that just the procrastination itself, the hysteria itself, costs the taxpayers money. So even while they're all saying, you know, the lawmakers and the government officials are all saying, well, we're doing this in the best interest of our constituents, we're trying to make things better for them, they are in fact costing taxpayers money by just not getting a deal done.
By all of this stalling. And we'll put links to all of these reports at our website, it's yourcallradio.org. Why don't we go now to you, Carrie?
Good story reported. Well, that's a tough one. I can't think of anything that's been exceptional reporting, but I could have a feel-good story.
Okay, we'll take that. We like to feel good.
The Mexican Soccer League had a new champion in the Tijuana team, which they are called the Cholos, but they are not the Cholos that we tend to think of in the U.S., the East L.A. lowrider Cholos. These are, it's short for a Aztec word that I won't even try and butcher, and it is a hairless Aztec dog.
Woo!
That is their mascot, the Cholos of Tijuana, and they won the Mexican League, and it was quite a phenomenal win for them, and it was just such a great boost for Tijuana, which is, as many people know, has a lot of bad news coming out of it, caught in the middle of a terrible drug war with three drug cartels, major drug cartels in Mexico, vying for that lucrative route into the United States. But this was a feel-good story, and it also has some quirks to it because the owner of the Cholos is Jorge Hank Ron, who is a very infamous character in Tijuana. He owns all the casino and the bookhouses there, and he also was a former mayor. But he has many run-ins with the law and many sketchy ties with the narco culture there. He was arrested once. One of my favorite stories was a long time ago. He was arrested crossing the Mexico border into San Diego, and he got caught with a tiger cub in his car.
Oh,
he was trying to bring a cub. He got arrested recently. The military raided his home. I think that was last year, and they found something like 9,000 rounds of ammunition and guns in his house. So he's quite a questionable character. But despite all that, Tijuana was celebrating something really fun that brought the city together, and it was really fun to see them rally around their team and the hairless Aztec dog.
The hairless Aztec underdog.
Como Mexico no hay dos, ¿verdad?
Yeah.
There's no other like Mexico. And let's also get Mike to weigh in here on either a story that you thought was done particularly well, or I guess you could give us a feel-good story as well.
Well, I'm actually going to bring up something that I don't think has been published yet. It's going to come out later today.
Exclusive.
Yes, it's a story by our religion reporter here at the Huffington Post, Joweed Kaleem, and he looks at all these folks who have created social media profiles on Facebook and other places and who have died, and what happens to those profiles. I think his phrase was something along the lines of we're developing these sort of virtual memorials, these sort of virtual memorial gardens out there with millions of pages that get left behind. And he sort of sorts through a lot of the difficulties that you encounter and sort of like, just how do you deal with it? You know, how do relatives and friends get access to these things if they're harmful or if they hurt people, or, you know, how do you update them if you want to make them into something more of a permanent memorial? It's really very interesting. There aren't any really rules or norms on how we deal with all that yet.
And when will we be able to see this story and link to it?
Yeah, it'll be at some point today. I don't know exactly when, because I'm not in New York. I'm here in Washington, but it'll come out there.
All right, well, we'll
ready to go.
We'll put all of those stories at yourcallradio.org. And let's talk a little bit about the week's news. Carrie, since we have you on there from the Capitol, the inauguration of President Peña Nieto took place last Saturday, and there were some anti-Nieto protests in the Capitol. Who's protesting, and how significant is it, and what's going on with the transfer of power here?
Right. Well, it was an incredible election if you think about it. Peña Nieto is from the PRI party, and the PRI party ruled Mexico for the majority, 71 years, the majority of last century, the 20th century. And so they had just been out of power for just two presidential terms, 12 years, and they were brought back in. It wasn't an incredible mandate for Peña Nieto. It was a three-way race, and he came in first with 38% of the vote. But he came into power, and there are many people that fear the return of the PRI. They were a very authoritarian government that ruled, one party ruled pretty much. They had been called the perfect dictatorship at one point by a famous writer. And so there was a lot of fear and trepidation about the PRI coming back into power. Peña Nieto had a strong group of students that were protesting during the campaign and continued right up to the inauguration. And also the leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who came in second, protested the results of the election for months. And a lot of people that were in the streets were also his supporters. But the protests, they were mostly centered here in the Capitol. They were around the Parliament building in the morning, and then they spread out to other areas of the city. There were a couple hundred protesters, and they were very violent, which was very surprising because most of the protests through the campaign were large and very, very peaceful, always peaceful. It was the start of a student movement that's called Yo Soy 132, I am 132, and it's complicated why they put that name, but they were very powerful students that got a lot of the word out through social media, and they were always very peaceful. So it was quite a shock for what happened on Inauguration Day.
What are they protesting, though?
I'm sorry?
What are they protesting?
They say that they believe that Peña Nieto was imposed on the people, that he went through fraud, whether that be not direct ballot fraud, but that he had control of the media here, and they were backing him too much. He got a lot of pro-media coverage, and that he bought a lot of votes, they say, through standard practices of political parties out here, giveaways, a lot of food and caps and other sorts of giveaways here. So they just say that the election wasn't fair, and they also fear the return of the PRI. But the protests were very ugly. There were students, they call themselves anarchists, and they distanced themselves from that other student movement. So I want to be careful about that. But they were throwing Molotov cocktails. There was a lot of destructions to buildings in the center of the Capitol. The hotel that I'm staying at was totally destroyed. That was quite a shock. Businesses, banks, and a lot of graffiti scrawling. One of the things that really upset the left-leaning mayor of Mexico City was they had just finished a $20 million rehabilitation of what's called the Alameda, which is beautiful park area and beautiful statues, and it was destroyed and defaced. And so I think they lost a lot. The anti-Peña Nieto groups in Mexico lost a lot of support with the destruction that happened on Saturday.
And one political analyst said that one of the notable moments was that as former President Calderon entered the hall for the inauguration, journalists covering the events cried out, God forgive you for the journalists killed or assassin. How's Calderon being viewed?
He has a very interesting legacy that he's left. He pursued the drug traffickers in this country vehemently for the past 6 years and really escalated the war on drugs here in Mexico. It depends who you ask whether it was successful or not. Overwhelmingly, analysts believe it was very unsuccessful. If you look at the death toll, you know, counts vary from almost 50,000 to more than 60,000 dead in the last 6 years. And, you know, what has really come of it, that the violence still in Mexico is at alarming levels. So there's an overwhelming feeling that Calderon's war on drugs was a disaster for Mexico. When he came into the hall, he was also shouted down by leftist legislators. They called him assassin. Other people were protesting Peña Nieto. It was very boisterous when he came in. But Calderon, it was interesting, as he left the presidency, he seemed sort of sad. He put this video on his presidential site where he is writing a goodbye letter to Mexicans. It was very interesting. It's very somber music, and he's speaking over him, this images of him writing this letter, thanking Mexicans for the past 6 years. And he's already left the country. He passed the presidential sash over to Peña Nieto, and within 2 days, he left for his new appointment. He has a job at Harvard. And people said that he flew out on a commercial flight. He was in the tourist class, and a lot of Mexicans on the flight to New York were very surprised to see him sitting there in the front row of tourist class. But he leaves a very, very sketchy mixed legacy as he leaves power.
And I read this New Yorker article probably a year or two ago that said basically with the pre-party that was in power from 29 to 2000, there was kind of a detente between the drug lords and the officials, and that was what was shaken up with this war on drugs. Do people expect the massive violence in Mexico to get better at this point because of Peña Nieto?
That's the big unknown question. You know, it's funny because when you, in his inaugural speech, barely mentioned the drug war. He did mention insecurity and violence in the country, but even in the campaign, it was barely mentioned. And if you're here in Mexico City, the city has transformed itself quite a lot. It's very safe compared to other parts of the country, especially the northern bordered areas. But it's an unknown what Peña Nieto is going to do with the drug war. He said he will make no pacts like the PRI used to do. He said he will go after the drug. What he says, it's quite interesting the way he phrases it. He says he will go after the violence associated with the drug trafficking, not the drug kingpins as Calderon had done, but more he wants to stop the murders, the extortion, the kidnapping that's associated with the drug trafficking. He's proposed to
form
a national police force, which he is going to scrap from Calderon's public security agency and put that all under the Interior Ministry, which has also raised some eyebrows here because during the time of the PRI, the heart of the PRI, the Interior Ministry was known as a political suppression ministry more than anything else. So it's curious to see what will happen with that. He also says he's going to strengthen the National Police Force, and a lot of things that, you know, nobody knows how he's going to pay for it or how he's going to work all the details out. But it's an unknown question. We'll just have to wait and see.
That's NPR's foreign correspondent based in Mexico, Carrie Kahn. And you're listening to the Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're also joined by Andrea Seabrook and Mike McAuliffe. And Andrea was nodding her head and kind of moving around as you were talking about all this in Mexico, Carrie. So go ahead, Andrea.
Carrie, hi. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
It's so good to talk to you. I was in Mexico for a bunch of years, but I'm thinking specifically about 94. I'm watching the turbulent elections of 94. And then I watched a rural voting box, ballot box, with a bunch of people lined up, dropping their pieces of paper in a slot. And a group of armed men drive up in the back of a pickup truck, lift the entire ballot box onto the bed of the truck, and drive away. And all of the Mexicans just stayed in line, waited for I didn't know what, and about an hour later, the truck came back and replaced the ballot box, and people kept on voting. This is the sort of, you know, it's like Mexico has had is having this epic struggle between democracy and peace, and they can't seem to have both. And so, you know, I mean, I think a lot of the Peña Nieto problems or questions are whether or not going back to peace means going back to corruption.
Well, if you talk to people, Mexico is much different than it was in 1994.
Sure.
I followed those elections, too. And so, but since then, they have built this independent electoral commission, the Federal Electoral Commission, which is very independent, has a huge budget, I might add, and has a voter-proof system. And there isn't that type of ballot box stuffing able to happen again. It's changed incredibly since then. But also what's changed is that the institutions in Mexico have strengthened incredibly. Democracy has come to Mexico and since 2000 and the decline of the defeat of the PRI.
Sure.
The Supreme Court is very independent. There's a transparency independent commission. There's more freedom of the press. There's different laws and institutions have been more stabilized, including that electoral commission. So it is a different Mexico. And if you talk to even like the stalwart leftists that are analysts, like Jorge Castañeda, who was a former foreign minister here, he says Mexico isn't what it was before 2000. Peña Nieto will not be able to do, and the PRI party will not be able to do what they did before. And so there is a lot of faith in the institutions. And I have to tell you, there is a lot of faith in Peña Nieto and that the political situation in Mexico is changing. I think a lot of the expectations are a little too high. I tried to temper them in some of my reports. But I was talking to a political risk analyst in New York, Wall Street. And investors are very bullish on Mexico right now. They believe that the climate with Peña Nieto as a leader and the political climate is ripe for the necessary economic and political reforms to move Mexico forward. The economy is poised to take off. Mexico has become much more competitive with China because of rising wages in China and also the proximity to the U.S. So there is a high expectation that this next 6 years is going to be a good one. And well, it's going to be interesting. And I'm looking forward to being here for these 6 years. I think it's going to be a very interesting time.
It's going to be very interesting to watch. And we're really glad to have you as the correspondent in the Capitol. And we'll hope to hear from you a lot about that. So let me just turn to one other story that you've been covering, which is this bizarre story of the antivirus tech entrepreneur John McAfee. Can you explain, maybe without going into too much detail, what the heck is happening with this man?
It's when you asked what stories were being reported widely this week, that one has been crazily reported.
Because it's a crazy story.
To the betterment, I think, of our journalists here. But he is, as you said, he founded the McAfee, the antivirus software company that still bears his name. The software still bears his name, and he made millions. He's been a recluse since he sold the company, and then during the recession, he had some bad business ventures. I think he made $100 million in the sale of the company to Intel. Anyway, he moved to Belize. He's been in Belize for a long time, and he's known. He lives on an island in Belize, and he was known as a very adamant, partier with suspect women always coming in and out of his house. He had problems with his neighbors by having some aggressive dogs there. But he also dabbled in some biochemical research that got him in trouble with the law there.
Is that drugs?
Is that code for...
He was cooking meth, and then he had some possible illegal firearms in Belize. But if you follow his blog, which he blogs constantly, he says he was being shaken down by Belizean officials and actually the president himself, who the president has gone on record to say that he said he was bonkers. But this all came to a head when his neighbor, who had complained about his aggressive dogs and the frequent traffic on their small private road between their homes, was found murdered This man's name is Gregory Fall, and he's from Florida, and he had moved there to retire and to police. McAfee was named a person of interest in the case, and since then he fled Belize. He said he went into hiding in Belize, and he said he needed to do that because he feared for his life and one of his girlfriend's lives. But he liked to blog, and he calls reporters all the time, and he plays pranks on reporters, and he said he was hiding in plain view, where one time he pretended he was a German tourist in a Speedo in front of his house when police were there, or he was a homeless man. Anyway, it got to the point where he crossed the border into Guatemala legally and showed up at some fancy hotel and held a press conference and said he was asking for asylum in Guatemala. Well, then they arrested him because he had crossed into the country illegally, and they were trying to deport him, and then it was last night he was hospitalized. He said he had chest pains, but I was just reading that he's back in the police custody.
All right, well, there's your soap opera story for the week.
We'll have to wait and see what happens.
We'll put a link to that story as well on yourcallradio.org. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm joined by Carrie Kahn, who's NPR's foreign correspondent based in Mexico City. And we've also got Andrea Seabrook. She's the founder of Decode DC. We'll put a link to that on our website. And Mike McAuliffe, senior congressional reporter for the Huffington Post. So let's get to this so-called fiscal cliff, Mike and Andrea. We just have a couple minutes before the break, but how are you covering these negotiations and the potential impact of this impasse, Mike?
Well, I'm listening to what everybody has to say. I'm talking to people. You know, it's the usual deal when you're trying to figure out something big and complicated like that. And, you know, I think the short answer to what's going on is people aren't really sure. And there's a lot that has to happen, probably mostly on the Republican side, before we're going to get a resolution to it. And don't ask me to predict it. I'll tell you it'll go one of two ways. Either we'll go over the cliff or we won't. And I can give you lots of reasons why, if you want.
Well, we'll talk more about that in just a minute. You've called this sort of a hysteria, Andrea. Well, how are you viewing this? What do we really need to know about what's happening?
Oh, you know, I think in some ways we, the media, and I mean to blame myself and everybody covering this, make this bigger than it actually is. We give John Boehner and the Democrats the ability to move the dial on news with the move of their little pinky. We've been watching this so closely, and every tiny twist and turn or lack thereof, that we created a monster in some ways. If we just went about our business and ignored them and said, well, we'll blame you if you do go over the cliff, but if you don't, fix it, you know, then they probably would work something out. The problem is they're under such a strong, magnified spotlight that the Republicans find themselves completely paralyzed by that light, and the Democrats can't do anything without the Republicans because the Republicans control the House. So it's a mess. I'm watching it very closely and trying to figure out what to say to your average American who's just saying, wait a second, I thought I just voted for things to just work, for Congress to get its act together and make some decisions.
But didn't the voters vote for gridlock by bringing back a Republican Congress and a Democratic president and Senate?
It's not that easy to say because the congressional votes are so district-focused. Actually, the Republican Party, by all sort of historical standards, should have gained seats in the House of Representatives, but they lost seats. That movement was considered as a disaster for Republicans under the Clinton administration, the fact that they lost seats in the off year during impeachment. But, you know, this time we'll see what happens, and we'll keep talking.
We will definitely keep talking about this. You're listening to Your Call, and that's Andrea Seabrook. She's the former congressional correspondent with NPR and currently producing a podcast and blog called Decode DC. We're also joined by Michael McAuliffe, who covers Congress and politics for the Huffington Post, and we'll continue to talk with them about this so-called fiscal cliff. And Carrie Kahn is NPR's foreign correspondent based in Mexico City. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break. All
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted on yourcallradio.org. They're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we'll have a conversation about the effectiveness of water conservation in California as we face water shortages. So how do we provide for 37 million Californians? And on Tuesday, we'll be joined by Jane McLevy, who's the author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. Michigan just passed a so-called right-to-work law amidst union protests, so we'll have a lot to discuss on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also comment at our website, yourcallradio.org, and we'll have links to all of our guests' information and blogs and articles there. That's yourcallradio.org. Today we're having our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're talking about the negotiations in Congress over the so-called fiscal cliff and trying to get an understanding of it. We're speaking with Andrea Seabrook. She's founder of Decode DC and formerly a reporter with NPR. Mike McAuliffe is a senior congressional reporter for the Huffington Post. Carrie Kahn is NPR's foreign correspondent based in Mexico City, Mexico. And thank you all for joining us. And I want to just give an invite to listeners to join our conversation. It's 866-798-8255. What news stories did you see or hear or read this week that were especially good? You can let us know and we'll add them to our links. What do you want to understand about the negotiations going on in Congress right now and how it works to actually cover this stuff? 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Talk, or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're also wondering where you get the best news about coverage of politics in Washington, and what do you think is missing from the conversation about these negotiations? In fact, what do you even think about the term fiscal cliff? 866-798-8255 is the number to call. So let's continue with understanding what's happening right now in Congress, Mike and Andrea. Do you think that we have a good idea of what it actually means to fall off this fiscal cliff? I was reading in Dean Baker had an op-ed in The Guardian of London. He says, you know, many of the nation's most important news outlets openly embrace the agenda of the rich and powerful that colors its coverage of major issues. And there was another one that was saying that essentially, most of the stories about how the country will fall into a recession if the deal isn't reached. Even a Washington Post editor should be sharp enough to understand this distinction. Nevertheless, many stories have implied that recession projections apply to missing the January 1st deadline. So how are you guys explaining what's happening to your listeners and to your readers? Andrea?
It's an enormous, enormous mess. You know, the basically the shorthand is this. The Democrats took control in 2006 and then of everything in 2008. They had an incredibly productive 2 years, during which time the right wing in America freaked out, built a movement, an amazingly important wave movement, the Tea Party. In 2010, they took the House. And since then, nothing has happened. There has been no budget. There have been no appropriations bills except continuing resolutions. These are sort of shorthand ways for continuing the government on with the budgets it has. There have been, you saw what happened in the summer of 2011, the raising of the debt ceiling. Remember, we almost went off the cliff then. What Congress did was make this incredibly convoluted law that would build a super committee. Remember the super committee?
I remember the super committee.
That was supposed to figure out a path forward. And if not, there would be these giant, horrible cuts that nobody wanted that would take place on January 1st, 2013, which is now just weeks away. Nothing has changed since those times. Every single thing the Congress has put forth and done has been a kicking the can down the road, to use our favorite cliche these times, and all of those deadlines are coming up at basically the same time. The reason we're calling it the fiscal cliff is because everything is coming to a head at once. The tax cuts snap back to higher rates under the Clinton administration. That's because Republicans pretended to end those rates 10 years down the line so that they would look like they cost less over time. We have unemployment benefits ending, extended unemployment benefits during a recession. We have those ending. We have the amount of money that doctors are paid under Medicare and Medicaid will drop by 30%. Doctors could stop taking Medicare and Medicaid patients. All of these things are coming to a head all at once. And if Congress can't get its act together and actually just come up with some consensus, boring, middle-of-the-road plan to keep things from being completely calamitous, then they will be calamitous, and that will force them into doing something.
So then, to me, this does sound like reason for hysteria. Mike, is that how you read this?
Well, I kind of enjoy the hysteria since I cover these things, but and lots of people read the stories. But I think of it more as a fiscal slope. One thing she forgot to put in there is the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, goes up, and that could cover something like 30 million people if it actually happens. However, all of these things are sort of slow-moving pieces. Even though they all start at once, they take a full year before you feel the entire effect of them, from the budget cuts to the tax hikes. And a lot of the tax stuff you can fix retroactively so that it ultimately doesn't end up costing people a whole heck of a lot. It'd probably inconvenience a lot of human resources professionals. But most of it you can go back and fix retroactively. So it's a little bit of a slow motion kind of thing. And I like the analogy of a slope because it's real and there's lots of huge things that are looming out there, and they will have negative consequences. In some ways, I think the argument about it is will have a much more immediate bad impact than the actual things themselves, because it just highlights that you're still in the same place, as Andrew was saying, as you were in 2011 when we got the credit downgrade because they couldn't figure out how to raise the debt ceiling.
Mike, can I ask you, who is going to be most affected by these cuts and tax increases? You mentioned unemployment. You mentioned the alternative minimum tax. I mean, who is this going to disproportionately affect? People who are low income, the middle class, the very wealthy?
It'll affect, I mean, assuming that they can't agree on anything, right? All the taxes go up. I forget which one kicks in when, but on the first and the second of the year, the cuts and the taxes kick in. It'll affect everybody. I mean, absolutely everybody, unless you're really far down the income chain where you really don't pay much in the way of federal taxes, it's going to affect everybody. You've got all kinds of tax credits and things in there that need to be fixed. So you'll feel it from pretty low down the scale all the way on up through the better off folks.
And let me say, I think what you're talking about, Mike, is that the actual tax rates, people won't really feel them necessarily until the year later when they're filing their income tax returns. Is that part of what you're saying?
A payroll office is going to have to adjust what they take out of your paycheck.
Isn't it true also that if income tax rates change drastically, they're going to have to take out of your paycheck your basic income taxes too, right?
Correct. They will have to adjust that and start taking them out. But if you're Congress and you've watched this happen, just imagine the pressure that you will be feeling to fix it.
Well, you would think that would be true, yes. But why are we in this stalemate after so long?
I think the biggest problem is over on the Republican side. There are a lot of relatively new members who believe the orthodoxy on taxes. Their voters believe the orthodoxy on taxes on their side. And John Boehner cannot get them to agree with what I'm sure he knows needs to be done. You know, you have to raise some revenue. It's pretty simple. It's not. It's really not complicated at all. But when you have such an internal war like that, it makes it very difficult. Now, the reason it becomes easier on January 1st or 2nd or 3rd when they first come back in is taxes are already up. Now you're talking about lowering taxes rather than raising taxes.
Politics of it changes.
Yes, the politics of it changes the day after. Now, I mean, it will be bad politically for the Republican Party to have insisted, no, we can't have these tax rates right up until you actually go over the cliff, setting off, you know, probably all sorts of at least temporary uncertainty and instability in the financial markets, and then you come back a few days later and say, oh, okay, we can live with those rates. I mean, it won't look good, but it's sort of the logic or the illogic of the situation sort of dictates that it really may go that way.
Here's my answer, short answer to why nothing has changed. Because the two parties have spent most of their energy trying to figure out how to solve this problem while making the other party look like the jerks. I mean, really, that's as much a part of the equation as finding a solution, is how each of them comes out looking clean, smelling clean, and making the other guys.
Well, I want to get to some of our calls because we've got full lines here. But what does it mean that Tea Party leader Senator Jim DeMint is suddenly leaving the Senate? Does that have something to do with this kind of internal Republican war?
I think it does. I think what Jim DeMint is doing here, and South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint is a huge force in conservative politics, and he was Tea Party before the Tea Party was cool. He is leaving the Senate in large part because Republican leaders in the Senate were bringing a lot of pressure down on him to keep him from meddling in other senators' races and other members of Congress's races, Republicans. The biggest fear among Republicans right now is being so-called primaried, a challenge from the right in their primary elections.
And it's got its own verb, being primaried.
Being primaried. And Senator Jim DeMint is a huge force in shifting money around among conservatives to primary other Republicans. By leaving the Senate, remarkably, he's going to have more power in a lot of ways to affect those races and those Republican primaries than he was in the Senate.
Interesting. All right, let's go to our callers. Marianne in Oakland, welcome to your call.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I hope I can say this succinctly, though. But a question I don't hear, and it's part of the formula, I think, for this discussion, is these changes and the uncertainty about them cost taxpayers a lot of money. You don't have a government that runs parallel systems. It's just too costly. So right now, I am absolutely sure that resources are being devoted to how can we fix the system, change the system, modify the systems to issue checks, to keep records, to alter contracts. And when that happens, the regular work of services and government functions are diminished. There's a huge cost to this uncertainty also when these appropriations and the budget isn't passed, because if they decide, oh, we also have to close down the government, just think when you go away for vacation, there's a lot of work in doing that. You don't do your regular work at home. You don't do your regular work at work. And to reestablish that in legal, financial, and HR ways is very, very difficult. So part of the formula I'd like to hear about it from this, an answer from the Congress and Senate, is who's paying this one? What services are being diminished because there's no chance to go back and catch up resources because nothing new will be added because of the budget restrictions.
Marianne,
so
let's
bring on more people to help you catch up. So there's going to be another loss out there.
Great. Let's get a response here, Andrea.
It's exactly the argument you're laying out is exactly the ideas that Brendan Greeley lays out in his Bloomberg Businessweek article, which really says, basically, when you don't have regular budgeting, which we all know we all should be doing, whether we do or don't, if you don't have it in something as vast and complicated as the federal government, then every single contractor out there, and there are millions of them literally, every single government service builds in sort of risk money into the equation because they don't know if they're going to get paid because the federal government isn't operating on a budget. They can't tell if they're going to be paid 2 months late or 6 months late, so they charge more for the contract. That gets charged back to you in tax dollars, and it means the government is able to do less with the amount of money that it has.
So just as we're starting to have a somewhat of an economic recovery, could this push the country back into recession?
Oh, in so many ways. Any mainstream economist would tell you that the fiscal cliff going through could be horrible for the economic growth and stability of this country because it will immediately take money out of paychecks. Yes, it's true that for the people who pay the least amount of taxes in the lowest tax brackets, theirs may not change so much because they don't pay as much taxes anyway. And for the more rich people who have a lot of spending money, it may not affect them as much. But for the vast middle class in this country, for whom it makes a huge difference whether they have $100 or $200 more dollars a month or not, those are the people pumping money every day into the economy. And if they can't do it, the economy suffers and we all suffer.
And we have a lot of callers, so I want to try and get to more of them. Brenda in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Oh, hi. Well, a couple of comments. One, going back, I think, to something that was mentioned earlier, but very rarely does get any airing, and that is that nobody seems to acknowledge that the tax rates in this country are probably the lowest they've been in 70 years. You know, a whole bunch of the population seem to believe that, you know, the taxes are higher than they've ever been, and it's totally false. So, anyway, that's basically my comment. I'd be interested to hear what you guests have to say.
Thanks so much, Brenda. Always good to hear from you. Why don't we start with you, Mike?
Yeah, well, she's exactly right. I don't remember what the exact number is, but it's the federal tax rate on average is somewhere around 17%, which I can't go back 70 years, but there was a study that came out of either CBO or the Congressional Research Service. I'm blanking on which one. But it found that it's at about a 40-year low. And that gets lost when you hear all the "we're taxed to death" sort of rhetoric that's floating around very freely out there. And, you know, 17% is a substantial amount of money for a lot of people. So it's you still feel it, but it is a historic low for the modern era.
And there was a recent survey, I don't know if I'm going to get this name right, by Quinnipiac University that said Americans are 2-1 in favor of raising taxes right now. I want to ask you about the coverage, Andrea. You covered Capitol Hill for 14 years, and you were frustrated because you said that the coverage was actually sort of colluding with politicians themselves because so much of what I was doing was actually recording and playing back what they were saying. And then you wrote, or you said, I feel like I am, as a reporter in the Capitol, lied to every day, all day, and there's so little genuine discussion going on with reporters. Everything is spin. Can you talk about covering this stuff and feeling like you're being lied to and feeling like you can't really do your job?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, let me temper that just a tiny bit by saying, to some extent, that's the game. It's politics. They're playing a game. They're trying to beat each other all the time, every news cycle. Also, let me correct you a little bit and say I was at NPR for 14 years. I covered Congress for about the last 10, and also hosted All Things Considered on the weekends. And the truth is that the way the Capitol works is these days every single party, every single leader is trying desperately to win the cycle. And one of the ways that they win the cycle is through me. They try and me, the reporter, or any reporter. They try and go through the reporter and get their talking points out there. And over the last, I think, about 30 years, the politicians, the parties have gotten so sophisticated at messaging and at PR. And I don't think we, the journalists, have caught up with that. Instead, our budgets have gone down. There's less money. There's fewer of us.
Right.
And so we are left with a decision of, you know, basically we, unless we are privileged in journalism, we end up recording a lot of their press conferences and playing those sound bites back to our listeners, which I don't think does them much of a service because we don't have the time or the space or the resources to say, what this man is saying right here, it's mostly crap. He's just trying to spin you. He's trying to
get... And why can't you say that? If that's the truth, and your job as a reporter is to give us the truth, to analyze this, to explain what's happening, I mean, you don't have to be that crass necessarily,
right.
But, you know...
It requires buy-in from your news organization. It requires a decision by the news organization to say, okay, we're not going to just blankly cover press conferences as if they're news anymore. We're going to cover the situation and explain it with more depth. There are news organizations that are better than others. I think NPR is among the best, mm-hmm. the gold standard, but it's not good enough. It's not good enough anymore because we haven't evolved with the sophistication of the messaging of the parties.
And that's Andrea Seabrook. She was formerly a correspondent with NPR covering Congress for the last 10 years, and she just left to found Decode DC. We'll have a link to that at yourcallradio.org. So how is what you do as a reporter now different, Andrea?
Well, I have made a pact with myself, now that I get to be my own editor, which, by the way, is very dangerous, that I won't cover press conferences as if they are news. For example, John Boehner had a press conference yesterday. Of course, he's the Speaker of the Republican-led House. He's the main negotiator in these fiscal cliff negotiations, where he said, this is not a progress report because there is no progress to report. That was the news headline. So you're in a situation where nothing happening is big news, and so all the reporters go to the press conference where the main negotiator says nothing and reports it that the main negotiator is saying nothing, and we're a moment closer to this deadline. I'm much more interested in what the possibilities are, how we got into this space in the first place. The way I see it, covering the government as a functioning entity is false. Politics, particularly Congress, is broken. And if we cover its products as anything but the products of a broken system, then we aren't telling the real story of the place. So that's what I focus on now.
And Mike, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think she's basically right. I mean, one of the nice things about being at the Huffington Post is you're allowed to have a little bit of a voice and call it the way you see it, you know, be truthful and fair, not necessarily he said, she said, which I think is a good thing. But, you know, another one of the problems is everything has gotten much faster, and even at a place like this, you need to do your work very, very quickly. And if you're third or fourth on the story, then you just don't get the sort of traffic that you would like to get. So you have to figure out how to both explain what you actually see as going on and do it very, very quickly. That makes it a tough job. But, you know, at the same time, you know, something like yesterday happens where Mitch McConnell filibustered himself. I mean, it's, as a political reporter, that's just wonderful entertainment, but it also gets back to the point that Andrea was talking about, where they've become so worried about winning a cycle and making points and scoring points that they lose sight of what their greater goal is, which is, you know, running the country. So in this particular case, Mitch McConnell offered a measure to let the president raise the debt ceiling. Right? And he offered it not because he believed in it, he opposes it, but he didn't think the Democrats would vote for it. He thought there would be enough moderate Democrats that it couldn't pass. So he wanted to be able to say, okay, see, the Democrats won't even vote for the president's plan. But as it turned out, the Democrats took a look at it and they thought, you know what, we can get rid of this debt ceiling debate. We can not have it hanging over our heads. Yeah, we'll vote for that, Mitch. Let's have a straight up or down vote. And then he filibustered it.
So we're running low on time. I want to read one email from Art in San Francisco. In regard to the media side of this problem, I think one reason for this standoff on the fiscal cliff is a result of people selecting divergent sources of media. We're not one nation in our news and our public discourse. Until we can bring ourselves back to an across the political spectrum national discourse, there will be an irreconcilable difference like the one we're seeing on the fiscal cliff that we'll find very difficult to bridge. The corporations control the media and Congress, and this is a major factor. What does your panel think about this? And if they agree, what can we do about it? That's a nice closing question. So
it's a good question, and I think it brings up something we haven't mentioned here, and that is this: the charges of bias against the media from one side or the other have caused such defensiveness among us, the journalists, that we have gotten ourselves in a situation where we build these false equivalencies between, say, global warming is real and global warming is false. We say that we essentially, by reporting both of those things, we create the idea that that global warming could be false.
But that's just bad reporting.
Well,
to have it be a he said, she said, on an issue like that where 99% of the scientific community has consensus.
Yes, I would agree with you, but it's still very prevalent. And in that way, we create the ability for some people to believe that climate change is not real, that it's some big hoax. And in that way, I think it's our responsibility to tell truth where we see it, regardless of where the political chips fall.
All right, Mike, let's get you to weigh in on this, and this will be kind of your final thoughts, what Art talks about that we don't have a common national discourse, that we're reading and seeing different media that takes a point of view.
Well, I think that is true, and the internet makes that possible. It's both good and bad. And, you know, I get emails from people, especially on a story like the one I was just telling you about, that it's getting a large amount of traffic from people who are very conservative. And I'm not sure where they're getting their facts from. And they accuse me of bias often. And then particularly today, they're saying, I didn't tell the facts because one guy just emailed me about 20 minutes ago. It takes 60 votes in the U.S. Senate to pass something. That's in the Constitution. It's like, well, no, it doesn't take 60
right.
votes to pass something in the U.S. Senate. It takes 51. It only takes 60 if it's a filibuster. So, you know, I politely explained to him, but there are these different places where some website somewhere probably told him that. He believed it, and so therefore he believed I was leaving out important facts and accusing me of bias. So it really is a hard thing, and I think the only thing that you can do is try and consistently be truthful. You know, even if you know that some people have a different political perspective and will think that you are not telling the truth, you got to stick at it. And, you know, and I try to engage with as many of the emailers as I can just to make that little extra bit of point. And, you know, it's probably, you know, 20 people, maybe I could convince them a little bit. But I think every little bit helps.
Here. All right. So try to be truthful for all of us journalists out there. And we're going to have to leave it there for our conversation. We've been speaking with Mike McAuliffe. He is senior congressional reporter for the Huffington Post. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
We were also joined earlier by Carrie Kahn, who is NPR's foreign correspondent based in Mexico City. And we were lucky enough to have Andrea Seabrook, who's the founder of Decode DC. She's been in studio with us. We will put links to all of their work along with the websites at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. Thanks to everybody who called and emailed, and I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up on Monday. How do we provide water for 37 million Californians? On the Next Year Call, we'll have a conversation about the effectiveness of water conservation in the Golden State as we face water shortages. What's going on with desalinization projects and city water recycling? The San Diego Water District is working on all fronts, and we'll find out how they are innovating. What's your district doing, and what principles would you hope they'd employ? Can we conserve our way out of our water crisis? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Next time on Smiley and West from PRI.
Education activist Sister Diane Ravitch.
In many, many communities, schools are being closed because of their test scores, and many of them are being handed over to for-profit companies, corporations. We are in the midst now of a full-blown privatization movement in public education.
Diane Ravitch next time on Smiley and West
from PRI.
You can hear Smiley and Wes today at 1 o'clock. That follows the Tavis Smiley Show at noon, which comes up after World Have Your Say, which is up next right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. Of course, you can always check us out online at KALW.org. Weather-wise today, we've got sunny skies, 60s for the temperatures. Looks like it'll be sunny and nice for the rest of the weekend, and then looks like a chance of rain on Wednesday. Stay tuned.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Nuala McGovern. Is it time for dialogue in Egypt?
I call for a full, productive dialogue with all figures and heads of parties, revolutionary youth and senior legal figures.
The National Salvation Front is not taking part in the dialogue. That is the official stance.
President Morsi gave a speech to the nation yesterday, and in it he called for a national dialogue. But judging by the response of a coalition of opposition groups, that's not going to happen anytime.